Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. New SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get.
Andrew, welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cal with you until 7 o'clock tonight. Coming up on the show, John McIntyre and Galway search for a new hurling manager, as Micheál Donoghue calls it a day. Damien Lawler on tips, key influence this season. Kieran Kingston's core credentials. That's a bit of alliteration for you. And Stephen O'Neill's departure from Tyrone. 2003 World Cup winner with England, Will Green, was going to join us ahead of the match at Twickenham this weekend. And England's chances overall in the World Cup. And all things football as well with Mr. Alan Cawley. 51552 is our text number. At Game On 2FM on Twitter if you want to get in touch. And Alan is with me in the studio. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good, Hugh. Yourself?
Pretty good. We got a text in the last couple of nights from Simon, who I believe you know, who was sending us in. We don't tend to broadcast all the little tips and knocks we get in over the course of the show. But Simon, if you're listening, we did follow your advice, and we're going to go
we're
for
smiling.
A little bite later on to celebrate.
We're smiling. So to thanks. Simon.
Star for star. Speaking of another star, I have to say, I was very, very impressed. We're going to do a roundup of York on Friday night with Don and Jane, but because we spoke about it last night to preview, I was very impressed with Japan's performance today. What do you think? Beating Crystal Ocean.
Well, the funny thing about it, Hugh, was it was almost sticking out that he was going to put in a performance like that, because if you go back to his last run in Ascot when he won, the interview afterwards, Michael Tabor, he actually said we were on, and obviously when the money's down, and he openly said it in the interview to I think it was Matt Chapman, the money was down, he says we fancied him strongly because he's our best. Those were his words.
Our best. And our best today went up against a horse. Let we just remind people, if you're not into horse racing, Crystal Ocean is the highest rated horse in training, higher than the brilliant Enable, who was going for three Prix de l'Octobre triumphs this year. And Japan, who is stepping back in trip from his last run, from a mile and four, mile and a half in old money, to a mile and two today. But people were thinking, no, don't have the pace, won't be able to get near Crystal Ocean. This is what he went and did.
Crystal Ocean now is being produced to take over. Crystal Ocean is the meat in the O'Brien sandwich at the moment. On the inside, weakening Circus Maximus. Japan on the outside. Crystal Ocean digging deep as he always does. King of Comedy, Regal Reality, trying to mount a challenge as well. Crystal Ocean just wilting out in front as Japan comes back to him. Japan and Crystal Ocean. Crystal Ocean responds on the inside. Japan on the outside. It's a tight one. Japan may have just got there from Crystal Ocean.
Yeah, there was no may have just got there. He absolutely did get up there, and it was an incredible performance. So yeah, he is going to, I mean, this horse originally, if you think about it, was being kind of talked about as a ledger horse potentially, so we'll have to go even further. Now we must come into the arc picture. I mean, when you think that Crystal Ocean got within what, a neck really of Enable last time out,
how much,
and Japan is going to go, I think he has to go for the arc here.
How much, Hugh, would you attribute the close race, only was it 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, to that performance?
Two weeks from Crystal Ocean. Yeah, less. So two weeks. No, look, it had to have taken something out of him. He had to battle hard against Enable, went down fighting. But look, it's a fascinating arc picture now that we're making for ourselves. And
Japan is certainly on the improve.
He's only up. He's only a 3 year old. He's only a 3 year old.
Well, I keep going back to that interview here with Michael Tabor. The words were sticking out. Those were his exact words. He said, "He's our best."
Yeah.
And for him to say that with the stable that they have, like, it's a hell of a statement.
It is. Look, we're going to talk Ian Holloway later on, which interesting, shall we say, his views on handball and the influence of the European. What? That European Union at it again, destroying the game, ruining everything. Why can't we just leave the European Union and make our own handball laws? That's all we want.
I was actually watching it live last night. I was actually watching it live, Hugh. And you know the video you put up earlier on Twitter?
Yeah.
I wanted to get the television and
throw
do that.
It out the window. I mean, just these. Look, here's the thing for me, right? And we'll talk about this a little bit later on. We'll play you the clip. Ian Holloway, if you didn't hear us, speaking on Sky Sports about why he believes the EU are dominating the handball rule and what they can do to change it. He has since, you know, rolled back in those comments slightly. But, you know, what stood out for me was this is a former top level manager, right? Who will have a lot of sway with a lot of football fans right across Britain and England and the UK, and he's making these views public, and people are listening and going, maybe it's a point, maybe we do need to get out of the EU so we can change the handball laws in the game of football.
He does have a lot of sway, Hugh, because he's a lot of platforms. He's on TalkSport, obviously that was on the Sky Sports Debate Show last night, and to be fair to Holloway, he is a bit of a character in football circles, but just stick
the
to
same way that Neil Warnock is a bit of a character in football
circles.
Yeah, like
circles. There's the YouTube clips and all that, and he comes out with funny anecdotes and stories and also the aftermatch interviews over the years. But the stuff he was saying last night was just laughable. Like, and obviously the way social media is now, it was all over Twitter.
Why didn't
and all
we,
sorts today.
What really annoys me, why didn't the FAI grab the bull by the horns when Thierry Henry handled the ball and we left the EU so we could have changed the rules for here so that thing wouldn't happen to us?
It was unbelievable. But don't get started on that rule again. And I was listening to a good bit of the show last night, Hugh, about the Pogba stuff. I haven't seen you since.
We're going to talk about this later. I want to get your views on the penalty, right? And I want you to have a think for me in all the dressing rooms that you've played, and there have been many, because nobody wanted to hang on to you for that long. You took penalties. Can you ever think of a situation where there was two of you on the pitch with the same rights and it's just whoever felt up for it on the day? We're going to come back to that a little bit later on. As I said, 51552 for any of your texts at GameOn2FM if you want to get in touch on Twitter. Looking forward to speaking to Will Greenwood as well to get the thoughts of the England camp ahead of this weekend, and I suppose in the overall context of Eddie Jones and the World Cup to come. First up though, I'm delighted to say that we are talking Gaelic games, and the big news today, surprising news you have to say, is that Micheál Donoghue, the Galway All-Ireland winning manager with the hurlers, has stepped down from the job. John McIntyre is of course a former Galway hurling manager himself, former tip player, and currently with the Connacht Tribune, and he's on the line with us. John, you're very welcome to the show, first of all.
Good evening, Hugh.
So look, this was a surprise, John, was it not?
Well, here we are just 3 days after the biggest game of the hurling year in Tipperary being crowned All-Ireland champions, and we're animated about something which could have a significant influence on next year's championship. I would say that the vast reaction in Galway today is one of shock, a degree of disappointment and some bafflement. But there were straws in the wind, I suppose, over the past week that there was the possibility of Micheál Donoghue not seeing out the next 2 years of his contract. And that manifested itself last night at a meeting with county board officials. He subsequently informed the players of his decision. And, you know, it's my overall reading of it, regardless of the background to it, is that this is a big blow to Galway hurling. People in the county would have perceived Micheál Donoghue as a winner. He did something that Galway hadn't done in 3 decades under a succession of managers. And, you know, that All-Ireland win 2 years ago was Galway's first in over 30 years. And they swept the boards that season, also won a National League title. Obviously, this year did not go according to plan. They never really sparked. They had a great win over Kilkenny in the Leinster Championship, which was their first defeat at Nolan Park for 70 years. But they didn't beat Carlow enough in the first round of the Championship. They could have been beaten by Wexford. And, of course, then they stumbled to Dublin in a key game. But none of us realised at the time, Hugh, that, you know, the result a few seconds later from Wexford Park would send Galway tumbling out of the Championship. But leaving all the speculation aside, I think the bottom line why Micheál Donoghue is gone is for family reasons. He has invested a lot of his life over the past decade in hurling. I think he's been on the sideline for 10 of the last 11 years. He was involved initially with Turlough Moore here in Galway. Then he took over his own team, Clarenbridge, and led them to a historic All-Ireland club triumph. Then he linked up with Eamon O'Shea, spent a couple of years with Tipperary, took a year off, and then for the last 4 seasons he's been with Galway, and I think his legacy will stand the test of time.
Do you, and because of those family commitments, I mean, we all remember the brilliant picture, the beautiful photo with his father in the aftermath of winning the All-Ireland as well, and his kids onto the pitch, you know, at various stages throughout the championship over the last couple of years. Do you think just the demands of time that is inter-county management at the moment were too much for him?
Well, I believe it was a factor, but ultimately, the family considerations, I think, were paramount, Hugh. And 2019 didn't work out for Galway. I mean, last year he took them back to the All-Ireland final. There was a little bit of a fall-off in their overall level of performances last year, but they still got to the final. And I think Micheál has only lost 3 or 4 championship games during his years in charge of Galway, which is a phenomenal record at championship level. And I suppose, look, at he would have been bitterly disappointed at Galway's earliest exit in the championship this summer since the loss to Clare in Munster in 1965. And there would have been a bit of natural fallout from that. But I think, overall, I think Galway supporters will be disappointed at this news. They're currently digesting it. And I suppose what complicates it as well, Hugh, is that there is really no obvious successor to him. Mm. I mean, names will be mentioned here and there. And I think that that is going to be a challenging time for Galway over the next couple of months to see who they are going to get to fill Micheál Donoghue's boots, because they're going to take a bit of filling.
And some names have already been mentioned. We'll come back to that maybe in a couple of minutes' time. Mm. I'm going to bring in Damien Lawler, if I can, of course, regular here every Wednesday night. Damien, how are you?
I'm Grant Hugh. Hi, John.
So hi, Damien. Good evening.
Just listening to John there, I mean, look, this is a surprise. Damien, as John has said, there are people just trying to absorb the news today. And look, I suppose you can understand if family reasons are to the fore here, that Micheál just feels he's given enough of his time over the last few years on the sideline as part of any management team, that it's perfectly within his rights to step down. But because it's such a surprising decision, it's difficult to know really where Galway go from here.
But 70 days since they lost the Dublin match, Hugh, and they exited the championship. You know, it's a long time. So why is this happening now? And like John probably would have been hearing stuff there the last few days or whatever, that maybe change was afoot. So what's happened in the interim? And again, like John says, with a young family, I suppose you're not going to put yourself out there if everything isn't just so. And maybe everything wasn't so for him. Did he have the kind of the long-term vision that he wanted? Was that being shared also? Were resources a factor? Were the backroom team, were they going to come back next year, or did anybody want them changed as well? And I think Micheál Donoghue wanted Galway to play a certain way. He probably wanted that to filter down into the underage. He had a marvellous coup when he took Lucas Curzon, the strength and conditioning coach, from Tipperary to Galway. I would say he wanted Lucas to work throughout the Galway academies. I'm not sure if that happened fully. And we get the news that we probably got last night. And John will tell you, John knows the scene better than anybody. With Noel Larkin and Franny Ford and Micheál Donoghue, you're right, John. You're not going to get an obvious successor that's going to bring quality guys like that into the setup. And I know they've tried hard to get Eamon O'Shea in there over the last few years as well. But the guys that they have are top class. And while Jeff Linsky's doing a great job underage, and Matty Kenny's been linked with, and so is Davy Fitz and Anthony Daly, you're not going to get a quality backroom team like that that the players had huge regard for. That's not going to happen overnight. I describe this now as a massive blow to Galway at the moment, to be honest with you.
You had a piece, John, in the Connacht Tribune in the middle of June, and the headline was, "Armchair critics suffer from short memories and condemnation of Galway management." This is in the immediate aftermath, of course, some, I suppose, below par performances in the context of their All-Ireland winning campaign. But equally, I wonder if you think that criticism had anything to do with Micheál's decision to step down.
To be honest, I don't think so, Hugh. Obviously, all managers would prefer if they weren't getting the flack, but that goes with the territory. And what Damien said there about Lucas, his conditioning coach, and working with the under-20 squad, Micheál would have liked to have seen that happening more regularly. There is reports of conflict between Micheál and the under-20 manager, Geoffrey Lenski, and that he also had a strained relationship with a couple of county board officials. There was also speculation that Micheál doesn't feel that Galway are as well resourced as other counties, like, we'll say, Tipperary and Dublin, for instance. But ultimately, I think all those factors they can be overcome if your heart really wants to stay in the job. And I just think Micheál has made a very considered decision. This isn't a knee-jerk reaction to anything. It's a couple of months since the bout out of the championship. And, you know, he would have taken counsel from his family. He would have obviously had the support of his backroom team one way or the other. And I'd say weighing up everything and the fact that there is a bit of a rebuilding job to be done on Galway now. A lot of those players have been around the block a few times. Some of them are even survivors from my own time in charge. And I left the scene, I think, was back in 2011. So, you know, you have to have the stomach for that as well. But, you know, I feel Micheál is a man of integrity. Curiously, I was coach of Clarenbridge back in 2001 when they won a historic first Galway senior hurling title, and Micheál played centre back in that team. and I would know him quite well over the years on and off the field. And Clarenbridge wouldn't have won that championship without Mihal. He was a terrific centre-back. He had tremendous wrist work, and his own inter-county career had been curtailed by a back injury. So I'd say Mihal Donoghue, you know, obviously when you're coming down to making a big decision, I mean, it's unlikely he'll ever be Galway manager again. And, you know, he weighed up everything. He knew the consequences of this decision, the implications of it for him, good and bad. And, you know, he has decided, for better or for worse, this is not for me in 2020. And I respect his decision, although on a personal level, I think it would have been in the best interest of Galway hurling if he had stayed in 2020 and presented himself with the opportunity and his management team, whether there was changes to it or not, to rehabilitate the team, because Galway are better than they looked in 2019. And let's be honest about it, you know, that result in Wexford Park on the same evening that Galway were beaten by Dublin, I mean, it was almost a freak. And who knows, if there had been a result between Wexford and Kilkenny in Wexford Park, how Galway would have got on in the championship. I mean, I do know one thing, you know, the gamble of bringing back Jonathan Glynn and Joseph Cooney from Australia and America, mm-hmm. respectively, just didn't work out. And that's no reflection on their conditioning or anything like that. It's just, you know, the conditioning of modern-day inter-county players has gone to a level that you can't afford to be away from 3 or 4 months, no matter what training you're done. There was obviously some criticism of Kieran Donaghy being involved in the setup, but that always happens when teams loses. And I was making the point in a common piece for the Tribune tomorrow morning that, you know, Cork hurlers had Dougie Howlett of Munster Rugby fame involved with them this year. So that's kind of something that happens fairly regularly. But of course, all these things come under scrutiny when a team doesn't get on as well as supporters anticipate.
Hugh, I would agree with a lot of the surprise element of this and what John is saying. Up until that result, I suppose, with the Dublin thing, Galway were very much in the mix, because we all know how competitive the hurling championship
was. Even without Joe Canning.
Absolutely, yeah, they were very much in the mix. But just to go back to Damien's point about obviously building the camp and the backroom team, I get all that, Damien, but surely from out-of-work managers looking in from the outside at this Galway squad, and I know, as John also mentioned, there's rehabilitation needed, but there's still a very much a very good team and a very good squad. Surely that's a hugely attractive job for all out-of-work managers.
Yeah, I would think so. Like, there's a lot. John left that job in 2011, as he said, and there is a few players coming near the end, and maybe there's one big last push ahead, and maybe those players want to devote all that they have before they do leave the stage. But you do have players like Donal O'Shea coming through in the next couple of years, Eamon Sun, and you have probably 2 to 3 successful minor teams coming through. Now, it's going to take them a few years to build up as well. I definitely think it's an attractive job. But just to go back to the point about the backroom team, I guess where every manager stands at the moment, Tipperary are All-Ireland champions. They had 27 on their backroom team. Seamus Cannellan nearly name-checked all of them last Sunday. It's probably on the high end of things. There's no doubt about that. But really, you know the way the trends go in the GAA. A lot of what the All-Ireland champions do in either code is copied by teams. So every manager that's aspiring to be on the sideline in 2020 is now going to be looking at this template. It's probably nothing new in that Dublin footballers under Pillar Caffrey had about a similar amount of people about a decade ago. But it's now back in vogue. And your days of maybe where a Brian Cody has just two lads on the line with him, Mick Dempsey and Derek Ling, and probably the physio, the doctor, and Noreen, the nutritionist, but few else, those days are probably in the past. And setups are demanding huge expertise. And that just could be a factor. It could be a factor, and maybe Mihal wanted more of that, and maybe that wasn't possible.
Well, then in that case, I mean, maybe it's not such an attractive job. I mean, you mentioned there, you've kind of alluded to potentially fractious relationship with Jeff Linsky in under 20s, with the county board officials as well, and the style that Mihal wanted to infiltrate right throughout the county, not just with the senior squad that he was in charge of. So on that basis, I mean, you look what Eamon O'Shea has done as part of Liam Sheedy's backroom team, not once but twice, and then in himself, a manager himself. Would it be an attractive job if... We all know, Damien, that news travels fast around Ireland, and it's too small a country, you know, to blacken copybooks for it not to get out. I wonder if people are looking out saying, well, hang on, if there's going to be problems and obstacles put my way in here, is the Galway job really that attractive?
Yeah, like, I mean, I think it probably comes down to the fact that they're one of the premier hurling counties, Hugh. Joe Canning is still on the team. They've got great quality players, the likes of Conor Cooney, the likes of Burke, Doughty Burke, David Burke. Throughout the field, there's class players there. And I think that, yeah, to answer your question, it still is a quality proposition. There's no doubt about that. The travel thing, it's probably not going to bring somebody from the far side of the country over, but there's plenty of people now from Galway and from Clare that will put their hands up for that job. No question of that.
Absolutely. Eamon O'Shea as well. I mean, like, a quick word, because I know, obviously, John, you played with Eamon, and Damien, I'll come back to you in a second, but in terms of what he's managed to do, I mean, you know, Liam Sheedy himself name-checked Eamon O'Shea, John, as one of the key reasons why Tipperary got over the line this year, and his willingness to come back and be part of the management team. What kind of a fella is he, John, from your days playing with him?
Well, he's obviously very humble, for a start, to come back. As you know, when you're chief executive of a company, to kind of come back in, I won't say quite on the factory floor, there's no ego there. And as we all know, he's a professor of economics in NUIG. He's a very busy man. And, you know, when he was actually in charge of Tipperary, Micheál Donoghue used to help out with their preparations. And I know you've been speculating there about Eamon possibly being a candidate for the Galway job. I see that as a complete non-runner, simply because you go back to the aftermath of the 2010 All-Ireland final. Great victory for Tip, stopped the Kilkenny drive for five, and within a few weeks, Liam Sheedy, Eamon and Michael Ryan left the Tipperary job. So I don't think, you know, they'll make the same mistake twice, if you know what I mean. And like Eamon, I played against him. I think he was the fastest player I ever came across at club level. He had an exceptional turn of foot. He was a mainstay of the Killer One McDonagh's team back in the late 70s and 80s. I think they won three consecutive county titles. My own club, Laura, and myself, we used to have great battles with him, and there'd be mutual respect between the two clubs. And, you know, Eamon has done a fantastic job there with Tip, and, you know, Liam Sheedy paid him the ultimate compliment, I suppose, since their fantastic win last Sunday. You know, that himself and Eamon have soldiered together a long time, and he couldn't imagine, more or less paraphrasing him, doing the job without his service. And, you know, Eamon is Tipperary true and true, and, you know, he's an innovative thinker about the game. He's a terrific coach. I mean, he gets the credit for the movement of the Tipperary forwards. And, you know, on a personal level, I was delighted for Eamon, because he came very close to winning an All-Ireland as Tipperary manager. And to go back in again with Liam this year, and, you know, it was kind of a belated payday for him a second time around.
Super stuff. John, listen, thanks so much for joining us. Very much appreciated. Thanks a lot, John McIntyre there. Damien, I suppose we were talking about this on Monday night, and we want to allow Tipperary the fullness of the next few weeks to enjoy this victory. But the thoughts already saying, look, can Liam Sheedy do it again next year? Can they back it up? And if so, will Eamon O'Shea be by his side?
Well, how long do you want me to talk about Eamon O'Shea for?
Because as long as you like, pal.
I could go for an omnibus episode on this guy. He's a club mate of mine. He was my first hero growing up as a kid. When Killer One won the 85-86 All-Ireland, I used to try and get in the dressing room and even get to sit beside him and talk to him. And when I went to NUI Galway, he'd bring me on a Monday morning to find out how the club and the team were doing. He would have been gone out of the parish quite a long time, but has never left the parish. He's still training the senior team down there. And I think back in 2008, I was on an All-Star trip, and we went to an official dinner. And I'm sitting down beside Brian Cody, and he was asking me, this must be the winter of 07, he was asking me about the new management team coming through, and he mentioned Liam Sheedy, and I referenced Eamon O'Shea, and very few people knew about Eamon at this stage. The likes of Jamesy O'Connor did, because he went through the Fitzgibbon Cup campaign with him, and totally changed Jamesy's way of thinking. All around Killer One, we knew what he was like, but the Tipperary County Board at the time had to be told about him, really, because he had been gone out of the county 20 years or so. He's a leading professor of economics for the aged and elderly in Europe. He's travelling all over the continent delivering keynote speeches. He's written, I think, 43 papers, 16 publications, academically qualified. He has better things to be doing with his time than getting in any way involved in hurling. I think he was out with the Salt Hill Jewellers the day after the All-Ireland final win. He's living up in Salt Hill quite this time. Absolutely no sign of him at the homecoming. The guys were down in Turles. A few people behind the stage were looking to know where was Eamon O'Shea, and I was laughing to myself. I mean, he wouldn't be seen dead at that. He probably didn't even go to the banquet. Job done, in the car, off he goes out west again. He's the most humble guy I've ever met. And to answer your question in a roundabout way, Tipperary, you've got a great chance if he's there next year. I've said it for years, the players absolutely love him. Lara Corbett and Seamus Callanan, they've seen their careers totally transformed because of this guy. Obviously through their own hard work as well, but they've bought into him, and he's got an ability to turn up at training, actually look and listen to the players, get information and feedback from them, and then decide what training to do that night.
Damien, and, sorry, it's so fascinating to hear you talk like that about him, because everybody since the final, and obviously John referenced it there about how humble, I suppose, Liam was in bringing him back and how humble Eamon was himself in coming back. But the fact that the stuff you've outlined that probably nobody knew about him, he's such a high achiever in his own right, that why wouldn't he be humble?
Like, because, you.
Yeah, but why wouldn't he be so humble when he's so high achieving in his own kind of respective world?
Yeah, he is humble. I mean, the parish we come from anyway, Clough Jordan, you wouldn't ever get too far ahead of yourself, because there's always somebody there, like, just to be straight with you, like, Lane Gaynor, for example, would have won several All-Ireland medals, and he'd be the father figure of our club. And I think Eamon would have played under him, and you're always about maybe just tradition and working hard or whatever, but Eamon was different to the rest of the lads. Eamon would be gone after the matches, and he'd be off in, he hurled for Dublin after Tip, by the way, and, he'd just be off in a different wavelength. As a say he's an academic professor or whatever, but I think, like, he used to go swimming with Lara Corbett in the morning time in Turles just to have the chat with him and see how he was going on. And Lara thought they were there, like, to make his hamstrings more flexible and supple and stuff like that, but Eamon was getting into him the whole time, inside in his head, in terms of reading his mind and what was Larry thinking. Eamon knew that for Tipperary to win in All-Ireland, Lara Corbett had to be on full pelt, and I think Lara got about 25 goals championship-wise under Eamon's watch. And again, what he does is, from the goalkeeper out, he encourages players to look into a field position where there's no player there, but in terms of using the field to open up space. And look at the way Cathal Barrett and these guys, Noel McGrath, look at the diagonal ball that they played into Seamus Callanan last Sunday in the second half of that game. And I'm sick of talking about it, guys. That was Eamon O'Shea's stamp all over it. And Liam Sheedy knows that. Tommy Dunn knows it. And Dara Egan knows it. And at the end of the day, the Mayor Ishka bib on him at the weekend. But he was the guy they kept going over to for reference point. And he's so humble that he had to be called into nearly the huddle at the end of it. And there is no egos there with any of them, because, Alan, you know elite sport better than anybody, having played professional football. And for two or three coaches to be in place, and for this guy to be parachuted in as well on top of them, well, sometimes that doesn't work. And most times it doesn't work. But for the greater good of Tipperary, everybody delved into it. There was a huge amount of variety at training. I think Dara Egan gave a lot of the speeches in the dressing room. Tommy Dunn is Tommy Dunn. Everybody's going to listen to what he says anyway. So Sheedy did what he does best. He got the best people around him, and they delivered an All-Ireland title. They probably delivered it a year or two ahead of schedule, I would have thought.
I think that's where Liam was class as well, because that little moment at the end when he's calling him over and the four of them are in the huddle. Mm-hmm. Like as Damien said, it takes an awful lot, Hugh, for a manager to bring someone in who's highly influential like that and be as humble and keep them part of the group without ever feeling, oh, he's more important than me or he's doing more than me.
Yeah.
And it is a team effort, and that's where you reap the rewards.
In relation to the job
and Eamon came over at the final, sorry guys, very quickly, Eamon came over at the final whistle. He was doing all these celebrations. About maybe 10 minutes later, I got a chance to have a quick chat with him. He goes, that's me, I'm done. And I said, yeah, until they get back to you next March again. Because I don't think he can say no to this bunch of players. And he's very wary that Donald is going to have, a great career with Galway going forward. I'd say he's very aware of that. But I don't think Eamon can say no to this bunch of players. He's with them since 2008. There's a massive loyalty towards them. And there's a temptation now to walk away because they're back on the perch again, but I think he'll find it hard to say no to them.
And in relation to the Galway job, just a text in to say Matty Kenny's the only man here. Well, maybe the Doves might have something to say about that. And come on, lads, it's obvious there's only one man for the job. Davy Fitzgerald, Galway is a lot nearer than Wexford, says Andrew in Kilkenny. Well, look, he's going to be linked with everything. We know for a fact that as soon as Anthony Daly heard the news this morning, he drove straight to Galway and was bashing down the door of the county board saying, I want this job. That's a fact now.
He was like Adam Wingy waiting outside the ground.
Damien, listen, before we let you go, can I ask you about Stephen O'Neill's departure from the Tyrone management setup? He was brought in obviously to bring the forwards on because scoring was a problem for Tyrone under Mickey Hart for, well, quite a long while really, given the defensive style that Mickey insisted upon keeping, if you like. What does it say to you that Stephen O'Neill now has decided to step away?
It's a disappointment because to be fair, with Cathal McShane and Matty Donnelly this year, they were shown absolutely, like, they don't have an iconic forward like they had with Mulligan or Canavan and these guys, right? That's there for all to see. But I would have thought they were moving well enough this year, and I would have been chatting to one or two people behind the scenes, and I would have felt that Stephen O'Neill had a role to play in that. I'd say there's massive disappointment that he's gone. He's his own man, Stephen O'Neill, now. He wouldn't be, like, Mickey Hart is obviously the main force there, but Stephen wouldn't be the type to agree with everything that just for the sake of it. So, I'd say he's definitely stand his own ground and have his own thoughts. But the main disappointment in Tyrone at the moment is losing Petey Donnelly. He's gone to Ulster Rugby as the S&C coach. And that's a massive blow to them up there. And they're still reeling from that because he was absolutely adored by the players. You can see the shape that Tyrone are in. They had prided themselves in being in one of the few counties that could go toe-to-toe with Dublin, and they beat Dublin in the league, and I know they got shocked in the semi-final, but they looked like they were on their way to beating Kerry. And I think Petey Donnelly's going to Ulster Rugby, and I think the players are devastated with it. I think that's a disappointment, and they're dissatisfied with it up there as well. So Stephen O'Neill leaving is not going to help matters either. Famously, Mickey used to have Gavin Devlin at the moment. He had Tony Donnelly there for years, just one right-hand man, Father Gerard McAleer before that as well. So I don't think the backroom team is going to be expanded there or anything like that, but they're going to have to shake things up as well because...
Surely the biggest shake-up has to be Mickey Hart.
Yeah, but like Mickey's got another year to go, and every time he's got a year to go, he always comes out of it with a two-year extension. So it's all very well us saying that, but there has to be a will to change up there, and I don't see that. I think that players are quite critical that they didn't go for Dublin up in Omagh and Healy Park that day, and they would have got Mayo in the semi-final, and they would have been capable of and confident of beating Mayo because Mayo were 5 games in 6 weeks. But they didn't, and I think people are very angry about that. But at the end of the day, county board officials, they seem to be backing Mickey the whole time, and his longevity and record speaks for itself. So it's going to take a monumental turn of events for Mickey not to be there next year. And as I say to you, usually with 1 year left in his term, he always gets a 2 year extension as well.
And so sure, where would we imagine, be without county board officials? Huh?
Well, I would imagine Peter Canavan, Fergal Logan, these guys, yeah, even Matty McLeanan, probably would have lots of new ideas to bring in and lots of thoughts and approaches that they could make the first move. If he stepped aside voluntarily.
Surely, if Damien, he feels it himself. Like, if Mickey Hart.
Ah, come on.
Like, but genuinely, for all he's achieved, and obviously an awful lot of you, but at some point you have to look in from the outside and actually take the decision yourself.
That point is past.
But I think he should take it on his own behalf and say, look, I've taken this as far as I can take it.
But if he was going to have that view, would he not have had it, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago?
But here we are, still 5 years later, thinking like he should be definitely gone.
But in fairness to him, they are playing behind the greatest team of all time in Gaelic football, which could be proven on Sunday if they do win the 5 in a row. And then secondly, he doesn't have an iconic forward, but he's got the team playing in such a way whereby they can strike you from 11 positions in the field, and they can have between 9 and 11 scorers per game. They got to an All-Ireland final last year and a semi-final this year. They are more of a qualifier team than anything now, in terms of they don't religiously win Ulster titles anymore. So I don't think it's all bad, in fairness. I just feel it could do being freshened up, but there has to be a will from the top to change things, and I just don't see that happening.
Yep, fair enough. Listen, Damien, thanks a million. We milked our pound of sweat from you there tonight, so thanks a million, bud. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Damien.
Super.
Double time, lads.
Lovely
double
stuff.
Time.
Damien Lawler there every Wednesday night, all things Gaelic games, and I hope the people of Tyrone are still going to present me with the freedom of Tyrone after that. I'm due to be up there about 9:30. Won't be cancelled, will it?
You're banging that drum a long time now, to be fair.
Right, a few weeks ago here on the show, we asked you to get involved in the Liberty Insurance Camogie Made Us Come
competition. The response was brilliant. It's all about giving another respect to the Camogie Youth Team coaches working at clubs right across the country. And we have five finalists from hundreds of nominations. They are Aidy McCormack from Banner Camogie Club, Anne Costello from Breda GAC in Belfast, Peter Doherty from Eden Dork GAC, Charlotte Brenner Senior from De La Salle, we heard from last night, and Carl Parker from Good Counsel in Dublin. All about the finalists this week. Here is Eva Lovell, who has nominated Anne Costello of Breda GAC in Belfast, and this is what she had to say.
Our Camogie coach, Anne Costello, brought Camogie to Breda GAC 15 years ago. This year, Anne has made us aware of the importance of looking after our overall health and well-being. Recently, our team has participated in a Resilience and Leadership in Sport programme, which was designed and coordinated by Anne. This included a brilliant session on mindfulness, a session on social media and positive body image, an art workshop, and positive role model mentoring from senior Camogues in our club. This year, my love of Camogie has grown so much. Anne really deserves this nomination because she is an inspirational leader and an amazing motivator who recognises the input of every single Camogue.
That's Anne Costello, one of our finalists. You can find out all five coaches and their video submissions on rte.ie/Camogie. Made it up to the 30th of August. The two coaches who receive the most votes will lead their Camogie teams out in the Skills Challenge final, where they could win €7,000 for their club from Liberty Insurance. Okay, 51552 is our text number. We have Will Greenwood after the break, and Alan Cawley is going to discuss penalties before the end of the show.
Text 51552.
Game on. Weekday from 6.
Charles in Dublin 12 says, "Here with all this hullabaloo about social media, etc., here's a radical solution to get the hell off it. As an old stager with no social media accounts, it amazes me that every sodder with a phone feels the need to inform the world of every fiddler's fart in their lives." Charles, I totally agree, but I suppose in the context of Pogba and the racial abuse that he suffered, Gary Neville, Phil Neville were saying, well, look, there does not need to be more controls about people who have accounts and can just post this stuff as anonymously as they like without any
that's the problem.
Fear of reprisal or any repercussion.
Harry Maguire tweeted about it yesterday saying
that
there
Rashford
should be
did.
But he tweeted that maybe there should be like a passport or driving license to actually prove who we are.
Would you give Twitter your passport though? That's the problem. You wouldn't.
But look, we've had our differences, me and Charles, but I agree with him totally here. Yeah. But then they're leaving themselves wide open to stuff as well. But the stuff about like people with anonymous Twitter accounts and are allowed to say what they want and do what they want, that's a scandal, Hugh.
Yeah, it is. If you look at the point brought up recently today in light of Boris Johnson's tweet yesterday, that if you look at the amount of retweets and likes that he gets and go through the accounts, they're all accounts that have been set up in the last two or three weeks with no posts, with no information behind them, just all these kind of almost anonymous accounts.
Well, the documentary on Netflix at the moment is brilliant and so interesting.
We're going down the rabbit hole.
It's horrible.
With me?
It's horrible.
Okay, we're talking rugby now. I'm delighted to say we have a 2003 World Cup winner with England, Will Greenwood, on the line with us to talk about the match this weekend and all other things besides ahead of the World Cup. Will, it's great to have you on, first of all. If I can ask you your thoughts on last weekend, of course, England losing out to Wales at the Millennium Stadium. What did you make of it overall?
Yeah, it was a kind of test match, first and foremost. I think a lot of people are watching at home and, oh, 13-6, not the best, but they're expecting a sort of World Cup war and five or six tries either side and everyone to throw it around a little bit. But getting off the train in Cardiff on Saturday morning at 10 a.m, it felt like a Six Nations game. You just can't have a friendly between Wales and England at the Principality Stadium. And that fed through, the atmosphere fed through to the pitch, where I think it stepped up a level from the week before. Wales were, I wouldn't say backed into a corner, but suddenly realised they'd had 110 on the trot at home. They were so close to number one ranking, and they were caught unawares the week before when potentially they were at a slight disadvantage with really knowing all 15 of their players were going to Japan, whereas English lads were desperate for a big performance the week before, trying to secure their place on the plane to Japan. And the roles were reversed just a little bit in terms of the desperation levels. England were desperate at Twickenham and Wales were really on edge in Cardiff. And I mean on edge in a positive physical performance. So I think a huge amount of positives. I mean, from a Wales perspective, great. They're in good shape. They're number one team in the world. And they look on great form. From an English perspective, there have been so many more positives than negatives over the first sort of 8 days, or 6 days in fact, wasn't it? It was a Sunday to a Saturday. So in good shape. They know if they get everyone fit and he picks his first team,
that squad, irrelevant of what other people think outside the group. Those who support England think they can go on and win it. Those outside, the Celts and the Southern Hemisphere, think they'll choke and not make it past the quarterfinals. But those that matter to them, those inside the group, I think will be supremely confident. They're in a really good position to attack a World Cup in Japan.
I know that Ben Youngs singled out Dan Biggar for his performance in the game, which I thought was interesting given the injury to Anscombe, and that a little bit of pressure on Biggar the last while. What did you make of his performance overall?
Outstanding. I mean, he came on Sky afterwards with us, and we had Mike Phillips at my Sky, my ice cream truck that they call it, my Sky car. Yeah. And he was unbelievably relaxed. He's not everyone's cup of tea, Dan Biggar. He's the way he kicks with his fidgets. I know they put that to sort of memes and music. And the way he has his arms in the air appealing. He's just a natural-born competitor. He almost, like Bill Belichick, the great American football coach, said, he almost hates to lose more than he loves to win, which makes him an awesome World Cup animal in that. He'll be right on it. He'll be so focused and keen and enthusiastic to lead from the front. Occasionally, as a fly half, you might say he takes a little bit too much contact, but he wants to be in the line of fire. His high ball skills are exemplary. I thought he was outstanding. I mean, I've got a load of English fans then jumping on my case saying, well, why wasn't the referee looking at the high shot on Itoje? But I've looked at the high shot on Itoje and he's tracking back about 20 times and he sort of jumps on him like he's riding a horse. I'm not sure there's anything overly illegal about what he did, but I think he was right at the heart of why Wales won last week. He was desperate to win, desperate to perform well, and I thought the English guys just at times got caught mentally in a warm-up fixture, in a textbook, let's do it correctly, and this is what we've been training on, where Wales just threw the textbook out the window and went at them in a feral fashion.
We Irish know what it's like to have an out half. It takes too much contact as well, so I know exactly what you mean when you say that. But can I ask you about...
I played outside one for 10 years.
Exactly.
which allowed me not to go anywhere near contact.
Brilliant. Can I ask you, though, about Eddie Jones' decision to name his squad as early as he did? I read mixed reports in England, Stuart Barron suggesting that perhaps, you know, it'll just settle the squad and give the players who might have been on the fringe more confidence now that they know they're in there. But equally, there is a risk associated with that, given there are three games still to play before you leave for Japan.
You'll get two schools of thought here. The English journos, by and large, are right behind this English team and will say it removes the hot air around selection. Those outside will say, well, they'll be too comfortable and they'll be together too long without any degree of expectancy or any edge which keeps those players performing at their very highest. But hindsight and time will tell. Eddie has done a huge amount of research, as Joe Smith has and Steve Hansen, all these coaches have done. They've done a lot of talking to players from previous World Cup squads where it hasn't gone well for them, and really since 2007. You might say 2007 didn't go well apart from the quarters and semis. The groups weren't so good either. So they're looking at that and saying, what went well? Where do you feel it could have been better? And aligned with the thoughts of previous squads and Eddie's own views as a coach who's taken Australia to a World Cup final in 2003 and an assistant coach to South Africa when they won it in 2007. And I think he's come to the conclusion that let's get rid of the chat. Let's kill the conversations dead about Cipriani, about Ashton, about Ben Spencer, Dan Robson, Danny Kerr, Chris Robshaw, Dylan Allen. Let's not have these lagging on into September and too close to the tournament. Let's just allow the lads with... knowing in his own mind that he was going to pick some bolters, allow those lads to arrive in Japan without anyone questioning their experience, because they'll have been in the squad by that stage for 5 months and it'll be old news.
And it must be lovely to have the confidence.
5 weeks, sorry, not 5 months.
Yes, five. Yeah, exactly. It must be lovely to have that confidence in Eddie Jones. Well, you mentioned his record in World Cups as well, going into a tournament like this. You know, for the England fans as well, to say, well, look, this guy knows how to go and win a World Cup. He knows how to get the job done in the tournament. The Irish might be a little bit envious of that.
Yeah, I mean, look, is that... I know I'm speaking to an Irish radio station here, and I'm wary of saying it, but you can't get past a quarter final.
Yeah, we know that. Yeah.
And you know that. The players know that. And I think there's a different mentality with Schmidt and this whole crowd. The only thing I'm looking at, however, though, is you lot are pulled with New Zealand and South Africa. So whether you win the group or come second, you're going to play one of the hot favourites to win the World Cup. So you're not getting it easy, are you? It's such a tough tournament to win now. I think it's stratospheres harder than it was in 99, even in 03, when really there were only three or four teams who could win it then. Now I think you generally have an argument to say there are seven or eight. If anyone can accurately predict the four semi-finals in the correct order, I don't just mean throwing New Zealand, South Africa, Ireland, Wales, England at the pot. I mean, pick the group winners and the quarter-final winners. I think you're a better man than most, and I'm off to York Races, so if anyone can pick those four and tell me the winners for the 3:35 tomorrow, I'd be hugely grateful.
Okay, just very finally before you go, Tom Curry, Will, there seems to be something a little bit special about him. I watched him underage level. He was head and shoulders above then. He seems to have advanced hugely in the last couple of years. How impressed are you?
Anyone who has no fear for their own personal safety and plays like that, I just have extraordinary respect for it. Takes me back to your Irish lad, your boys, who threw themselves in front of, Wallace in the old days on the flank for Munster was insane. Lewis Moody was ridiculous. Each country has these young players who come through and who are prepared to do anything for the cause. On top of that, he's got a bit of nous about him. He knows when to go in and when to hold off. He's got half decent set of hands on him. So, he's an outstanding player, but either him or Underhill, we're very lucky to have those two options as a seven, or even if we want to play a fast game, one of them at six, one of them at seven. So we're in good shape. No one's getting overexcited. I'm not tipping England to win this World Cup, but I do believe they'll go, and whoever beats England, I'd be backing heavily to win the thing.
Okay, listen, you've been brilliant with your time. I know you're off to see Leeds beat Brentford tonight. Liberty Beach will win the first race at York tomorrow, Will, so that's our tip to you. Okay,
win it, there you go. Fantastic.
Liberty
and that
Beach
actually picks up a really good campaign for women's rugby that Guinness have done about Liberty Fields.
Brilliant.
Which is worth looking at online. They did a campaign about a young Japanese women's team who set themselves up in 1989, came up across all sorts of obstacles and just gender stereotyping about they can't. No, they mustn't. And their story of forming a women's rugby team in Japan in the late 1980s is one that's worth watching. And it's great to see World Rugby removing any sort of gender titles from the World Cup from 2021.
Yeah.
They will simply be World Cups, whatever sex they're playing.
Exactly, and it's a fantastic initiative, really well received today as well. Will, enjoy tonight and the racing tomorrow and the match of the weekend. Thanks a lot.
Game on. Check out the podcast on the RTÉ Radio Player app.
You'd be a good man for the double denim, wouldn't you?
I like
double denim look.
I don't mind a bit of double denim,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, I know you don't. Yeah.
I carry it off as well.
You do, yeah.
With the pink jumpers.
You do carry it off in 1984. Will you ask Will about Danny Cipriani, why he's not being considered? Sorry about that one. He just got the text as Will left, and he was under pressure this evening because he's off to see the Leeds match, as we said. But we might talk about it with Bernard Jackman, who's in tomorrow to go through the team. We will have an Irish team named tomorrow around about lunchtime to play England at Twickenham on Saturday. One of the stars or the players that you thought really stood out for the Republic of Ireland under-19s, Mr. Afolabi, has signed a deal.
I'm delighted, Hugh. I was absolutely mad about this kid during the under-19 championships. He was brilliant. And
where is he off to?
Celtic. He's just signed a 3-year deal with Celtic. And the way Celtic are going currently, and obviously the Scottish League, I think it's a brilliant move for him. Because the one thing you always say with young lads coming through, regardless of the potential, you have to look at where they're going to get an opportunity. And you have to pick your teams well and pick your clubs well, and so many fall down the trap of choosing the wrong club where there's no pathway or progression. And you look at Afolabi at the moment, he has all the attributes. Hugh, he got named in that team at a tournament for the European Championships under 19. It was mind-boggling as to whatever happened with Southampton or why he was released. And still to this day, I'm not so sure if anyone can enlighten me. But certainly from a personal point of view, for himself, moving to Celtic, I think he'll get an opportunity, and he is a huge future, that lad.
Okay, talk to me about two penalty takers on the pitch at any one time. What is Solskjaer's thought process here that he has both Marcus Rashford and Paul Pogba as designated penalty takers? Do you agree with it?
No, not in the slightest, Hugh. No, I don't agree with it at all. And I couldn't believe the interview afterwards. I probably could believe what he was saying because he strikes me as being a little bit weak.
Is it weakness, though, or is it looking after the best interests of the squad?
Yeah, but that's not looking after the best interests of the squad, Hugh, because it cost them 2 points the other night. You should have a designated... And I thought there was a bit of steel about Solskjaer. And maybe there is, I don't know. Because you don't survive in the dressing room he survived in for so long without having a bit about you. Even though he might look all happy chappy.
Most of that was on the bench, though.
Yeah, but he was... like they had a hell of a dressing room, Hugh. And he was heavily involved in that. And he was instrumental in a lot of the success, even coming off the bench. Mm. And he was well-respected, and he still is well-respected. But I think he's pandering a bit to Pogba. And you can't do that. And I said it at the end of last season. If you have a player who doesn't want to be there, get rid of him. And I think Solskjaer's credibility would have went through the roof if he had to stand up to him and say, okay, if you don't want to be here, gone. Get rid of him. So now we have a situation where he's playing and it looks like he may stay, even though he's still publicly wanting to leave. And the game the other night, Rashford scores the penalty last week. Mm-hmm. And I remember commenting on it on the Monday we were here, saying I was really impressed with Rashford because it looked to me as though he took the ball off Pogba and said, okay, and I remember saying it, look, if I'm in it for the long haul, which he is, Rashford, maybe you're not, took the ball, took responsibility, scored a penalty. If you go back to PSG a few months ago when Pogba was suspended, Rashford took a crucial penalty, a brilliant penalty. And him, I wouldn't blame Pogba necessarily. I'm blaming Solskjaer, I'm blaming Pogba, and I'm blaming Rashford as well, because...
Well, Rashford is probably the least culpable here, because he's the younger player here. Yeah. Paul Pogba's the World Cup winner, the $100 million price tag, whatever you want. He's the alpha in the
dressing room. The responsibility lies with the manager for me, because he should have a designated penalty taker and pick one. The least one is, as you say, Rashford, but where I would blame him is... It's free goals, Hugh. If you're a centre forward and you get a penalty, it's a free goal almost. So you look at Shearer, all the goals he scored from penalties. You go through 256 Premier League goals. How many were penalties? Andy Cole, all these fellas. It's a free goal. He should be basically saying to Pogba, give me that ball. Yeah. And you're not getting it, whether he wants it or not, especially after scoring last week. Then Pogba's missed 4 as well out of 12. So I don't know where Solskjaer's coming from. He needs to make the tough decision and say, I'm sorry, Paul, you had your chance, and now Rashford's on penalty. Simple as that. You can't be having a debate over every penalty that's given, because if you're at that, and it looks terrible from the outside, because whatever cloud is around them already, Man United, and there is a little bit of a cloud over them, that just brings so much unnecessary criticism on them that they didn't need.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. We'll pick it up again on Friday. We're going to preview the Premier League fixtures as always. My thanks to Ronan Lawler, who produced tonight. Andy Dupuyre was our BCO, and Tara Stewart is on the way. We're going to take a quick break first.
Game on.
On 2FM. Weekdays from 6.